This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Welcome to Birth to Work Radio and the voice of the community stakeholder leader. It is a great privilege today to be able to welcome Jill Bolte Taylor, a doctor and a researcher in the area, as she calls herself, a brain scientist, and someone who has been on a personal journey for about the last 10 years, having to do with her own personal experience in the area of brain injury. But before we get to you, Dr. Taylor, may I call you Jill?
Please, yes.
Thank you. And I wanted to give a little bit of background as to why this particular topic is of such interest to my co-host, Rick Stevens.
Hi, Elaine.
And why we're interested in this area. About 30 years ago, when I first had my own daughter, Stephanie, I had an experience where I went and took a week-long parenting class called How to Multiply Your Baby's Intelligence. And it was put on by an organization called the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential. Physical therapists in a laboratory that had been working with stroke victims and brain-injured children for many years, who discovered that the same kinds of activities that were helping parents do wonderful things to help brain-injured children and other stroke victims improve had a nearly miraculous effect on children who were not brain-injured. And in fact, those particular techniques had to do with the relationship between physical movement and language and cognition. In other words, the two were not separated, but were rather interwoven into this process. And for many, many years after that class, for which I did get indeed a certificate that called me a professional mother, I was very proud of that. And
I think that's great.
Isn't that great? I got a professional mother certificate. And for many years after that, it was some time before I ever came across anything as profoundly related in what I would call an accurate way or a way that related as your own story. And I would really appreciate it if you would talk to our listeners a little bit about what happened.
Well, I had I grew up to study the brain because I have a brother who's been diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia. And my brother was only 18 months older than I was, so he was my constant companion as children. And everywhere we went, we went together, and he was older than I was, so he was introducing me to the world through his eyes. And I realized by the time I was very young, maybe 4 or 5 years old, that my brother was very different from me in the way he perceived an experience and in the way he chose to interact with the world. So I became fascinated with who are we, what are we doing here, how is it that two of us can have the exact same experience but walk away with completely different ideas about what just happened. And so I grew up to study the brain. And so I was a brain scientist at Harvard, teaching and performing research. My area of specialty was postmortem investigation of the brain as it relates to schizophrenia, because I wanted to help people like my brother. And I woke up one morning, and I was experiencing a major hemorrhage in the left hemisphere of my own brain. And so in the course of 4 hours on the morning of the stroke, I lost all my ability to identify the boundaries of my body, where I began and where I ended. I lost all language. I lost all the skills of my left hemisphere and shifted into the consciousness of my right hemisphere, which is all about a more holistic picture. It's the big picture. It thinks in pictures. It is right here, right now, present-oriented. So, through the eyes of a scientist, it was quite a profound journey for me to, in the course of 4 hours, watch my own mind completely deteriorate to where I could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life. And I didn't know what a mother was, much less who my mother was. So I was truly disconnected from normal reality.
Well, Jill, it's an amazing story that you walk through, and I invite all of our listeners, if they've not had an opportunity to see the video, is to Google you, and that video comes right up. And I also invite them to read your book, My Stroke of Insight, which really does a terrific job of outlining all of what you went through. What was interesting to me as I was going through, particularly given your background, it took a little while for you to recognize kind of the situation that you were in. What kind of got you into the point that says, wow, I'm really in trouble? Because as you said, it was kind of over this four-hour process that this occurred.
Well, in the beginning, I woke up with an excruciating pain behind my left eye that was pulsating. And it was very unusual for me to have any kind of pain. I was in really good shape. I had exercised every day. I take good care of myself. I eat well. At least I thought I did. And I had no risk factors for stroke. So, of course, I didn't even consider that I was having a stroke. So through the eyes of a scientist, though, I'm curious about what's going on inside of my head. I was looking at my hands and realizing that it was as though my consciousness had shifted away from my normal perception of reality, of me being in my body having the experience, to me being outside of myself witnessing myself having this experience. So for me, it was a very exciting and interesting experience. But when I was in the shower, I was leaning up against the shower wall because I had lost my balance. And I realized that I could not identify the boundaries of where I began and where I ended. And I had this, I turned the water on in the shower. And, again, I'm not thinking that this is gravely disabling, that I'm not in serious trouble. Maybe I'm having a migraine. What else could this be? But it was, I had this radiating pain in the shower from my chest pushing up into my jaw. And I know that that's one of the warning signs for heart attack in women. They will have generally a pain in the chest that radiates to the jaw. So at that point, I knew I was in danger, and I had to get out of the shower and make a plan to get help. But I kept becoming totally detached from normal reality and my ability to navigate my way through normal processing. And so I would drift out into this right hemisphere consciousness where totally detached from the details of my life. I lost perception of my job, and all the stress went away with that. And I lost all my history, my memories of my life. And in the absence of that, there was this release and no longer awareness of my own emotional baggage. So I felt quite elated and quite joyful and quite in this space of euphoria. So I would drift in and out of this experience of euphoria or nirvana, where I'm just totally at peace with all that is, with no boundaries to my body, and I felt enormous and expansive and as big as the universe. And then I would have these moments of waves of clarity when I would drift back into normal reality and attend to detail again. And eventually my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side, and that for me was the warning sign, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. That's when I realized what the real problem was.
So a true scientist at heart trying to analyze what's going on as you're fading in
yeah,
and out.
Yeah, well, it had been my area of specialty for so long about how does our brain create our perception of reality, and here I was given this incredible up-close and personal opportunity to lose my own left hemisphere. But I was still conscious.
Wow.
And so, it was a magnificent process of exploration that morning.
So this was what you were losing, though, was the language aspect, the words that limited you or told you where you were and what you were doing. And in fact, you were in total immersion of the experience.
Yes, exactly. I lost all words, all language, the little voices, ongoing voices that are normal inside of our brain that reminds us that we need to pick up something for tomorrow, or, you know, the calculating intelligence that tells me I have to do my laundry because it knows how to count my clothes, and all of that normal verbiage, that normal detail information that our brain talks to us all the time, that was totally silent. And in the absence of that verbiage, I shifted into just this experience of the present moment, and it was really a blissful experience for me.
Boy, what a great introduction in terms of getting everyone excited about what's going on. Joe, when we come back, maybe we can start going in. So what did you do in terms of, what was your recovery process? Because I think that's the important part we get across, to help people understand the important capabilities that we all have within our brain and how we can shape and mold it based upon the environment we're in. This is Rick Stevens with Elaine Scott, and delighted to have Jill Bolte-Taylor, a brain scientist, the author of My Stroke of Insight, with us today. We'll be back in a few moments.
We're talking with Jill Bolte-Taylor, and Rick Stevens and I are just sitting here in complete awe and delight that we have the opportunity to go a little bit further with you. We were just talking about your experience in having had a stroke and the feelings that vacillated between a kind of euphoria in the middle of this experience, being not limited by the language of words or limitations of frames of thought. And then you realized you're having a stroke. And one of my favorite parts of your video presentation was the story about you talking on the telephone. And I actually talk about that. That for some reason, being an auditory person, was very real to me. But at the same time, there was that next phase, that part of it that Jill had to deal with, and that was the recovery. And I'd like to have you talk a little bit about that and what that was like for you.
Well, I was totally blessed to have my mother, and I should give her that award that you got, because I wouldn't be here talking to you if it hadn't been for my mom. And she came back into my life. She was living in Indiana when I was in Boston. And she moved back into my world, and she took over everything. She took over all my finances, and I was her infant. I was her infant again. And she dealt with me absolutely graciously, kindly. She was just a wonderful, wonderful role model of a human being in my life. And she had to teach me how to walk and how to talk and had a new vocabulary. She had to teach me what a grilled cheese sandwich was. I mean, she had to teach me everything from scratch again. Reading, she taught me how to read. I hated it. It was very difficult for my brain to grasp abstract thought. But she was really wonderful. So because I had her in my life taking me step by step, we had a very successful recovery. And I say we because, you know, when you're in that condition, you certainly don't go through this process by yourself. And I'm just very grateful for the circumstances of my caregiving.
Jill, if I can, a little bit, help the audience understand physiologically what was going on. As I understand, the stroke was in the left hemisphere, so the right hemisphere was not impacted. But when the stroke was over, was there damage to the left brain, or was it a matter of just wasn't working properly, and so it was a matter of getting it rewired? What was going on, is it physiologically, so people understand that?
Well, I had a hemorrhagic stroke. It's called an arteriovenous malformation, or an AVM. And with an AVM, it's essentially a varicose vein inside of the brain that cannot handle the high pressure coming from the artery. And so eventually this was a bomb in my brain waiting to blow. And usually arteriovenous malformations blow between the ages of 25 and 45. So often when you hear of a relatively young person in their prime who has experienced a stroke and died, it is often because of an AVM has blown. So what happened once that artery and vein blew off of one another and blood seeped into my cranial vault and pushed blood against my brain, and, you know, the skull is a very fixed size. so if you have increased fluid going into the brain cavity, then it's going to push with pressure up against the brain. And so I had this blood clot the size of a fist that was pushing against my left hemisphere and making the left hemisphere swollen and no longer functional. And on the morning of the stroke, my whole brain ended up being pretty swollen, and it took a little time and in inflammatory steroids in order to get the swelling to go down. So in the beginning, when you have this type of trauma, all the neurons, all the cells of the brain are pretty much stunned and shocked and non-functional, and you don't know where's the damage, where's the specific damage, which cells are going to die, and which cells are going to eventually be able to recover function. And so for me, the hemorrhage happened right near my language center, and so the right behind the language center is where we do mathematics. And for me, the cells that died were the cells that understood mathematics. My language, well, I was very fortunate, my language came back online eventually with training, but mathematics eluded me for 4 years. You could say, Jill, what's 1 + 1? And I would hunt and hunt and hunt for an answer, and then I'd say, what's a one? I didn't understand even the concept of mathematics, yeah, much less the ability to perform the function. So depending on where the problem is and which cells are permanently disabled and which cells then are simply traumatized and need time to recover, will depend on the overall recovery of the individual.
So this, in essence, is a rewiring of the brain that you had to go through.
Yeah.
And because
Some of it, once the swelling went down, the cells that had performed specific functions could relearn function. But again, I had to learn vocabulary over. I had to learn how to communicate with language over again. And then other areas of the brain had to take over those functions and have rewiring in order for me to have the concept of what's a 1 + 1.
Now, talk to me about how you did that. How did you know what to go do? Because we were given a specific relationship between body, movement, language, and visual and auditory. I mean, all these things, all the full sensory things, and I know you talk about this in your book, so I'd like for you to give our listeners a little bit of a sense of what that's about.
Well, in order for me to just understand language, I mean, what does that really mean when somebody doesn't have language? And for me, what that meant was you could say to me, Jill, how are you doing? And I would hear, I would hear the sound, I would hear the intonation and the inflection of the voice, but I would have absolutely no clue what you were actually saying to me. What were the words you were speaking? Because all I was hearing was sound with no meaning. And so in order for me to try to understand what you were saying to me, I had to consciously choose to pay attention to you. And my information processing through all of my sensory systems was very different at this point, where light burned my brain like wildfire and was extremely painful, so I squinted and hid my face and begged people to dim the lights. And sounds were just loud and chaotic, and I could not distinguish a voice from the background noise, so I couldn't focus in on your voice anyway. So I had to pay attention to your lips and your facial expression and try to use all of me in order to figure out what are you communicating to me. And I was in very slow motion information processing than a normal person. So I might be in a state of trying to pay attention and not understand anything and still be thinking about that for hours later, trying to analyze. You just said to me, Jill, how you doing? Well, to you, Jill, how you doing is really not a significant conversation. Because it's just one of those, niceties that we do in conversation. But for me to go through all of that effort in order to figure out what did you say to me required a willingness on my part, a patience on my part, a determination on my part, lots of sleep so that I could try to to rest everything and then come back to the whole conversation again and try to analyze what just happened. So it was very disconnected. My thoughts were completely disconnected from one another. And in your program, when you're using all of your senses as well as the movement of your body, the kinesthetic movement of your body in relationship to things like language, you're creating a complicated network inside of the brain that makes things work better together. And to me, that's the ultimate goal of any kind of communication at the nervous system level, is how do you get things interrelated enough that things really can make sense in the form of cognition.
And was that, had you ever seen or heard or known anything about that, like that in the past? I mean, was that how you understood it prior to your own personal experience?
No, I was always very athletic, and so I would often when I was studying for my doctorate, et cetera, I would walk a lot, or I would bounce on those trampolines. This was back in the 80s when we had all the little trampolines, and try to create an association between my movement and my thinking. But mostly it was, I believed that movement of the body exercised the brain and was good for it, and I believed that thought and cognition stimulated the body and was good for it. And so from that perspective, yes, but from, you know, a really analytical perspective, no.
Unbelievable.
So probably one of the challenges that you had is here you are a woman in a woman's body, but with a brain who's really trying to recover. And so people would probably come at you expecting that your brain is in full place, and when I look at your 40 things I needed most as a brain injured, first is, I'm not stupid and I'm wounded, please respect me, you know, come close, speak slowly and naturally. Clearly, those were important elements about what you needed in order to get your brain wired back again so you could figure out how to respond in this new environment.
Yeah, I was completely disconnected, and when you're disconnected from really communicating with language, there you have to depend on everything else. And everyone says to me, you know, but how did you remember action by action, moment by moment, the morning of the stroke? And I say, well, you know, I wasn't unconscious. I just lost my left mind. But that left me with a whole right mind that was capable of perceiving information and having a conscious experience. And it would be very much like, if all of a sudden you wake up one morning and you're in the middle of China and you don't speak any Chinese and they don't speak any English, you're going to pick up a whole lot of conversation. You're not going to understand any of the words that the people are saying, but you're going to understand facial expression. You're going to understand intonation and inflection. You're going to understand so much of the big picture. You're just going to be lost in the details. And that's exactly what happened to me in having this experience.
We are so excited about that. We want to cover more of that when we come right back.
This System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott, is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The system, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birth2work.org or amazon.com.
Wow, we're just having such a great time, and this is such an important conversation. We were just talking about the redevelopment of the brain around the use of mathematics and language and kind of the significance of words and visualization and sound and light. And in other words, all those sensory pathways that are in play that create a much more sophisticated and a much more meaningful relationship in the body through all the neural pathways. Now, as I mentioned early on in the program, a long-term interest in this, but I certainly don't have the sophisticated degrees or the formal training, but I have been an informal observer and a researcher in this area on my own for over 30 years, and recently was, in fact, in the last week, had the opportunity to attend a conference called Decade of the Mind 4, which is a part of a series of conferences going on with neuroscientists and cognitive scientists worldwide who have finally made a decision to come together, having worked apart, which was why I was asking you about the relationship between words that you were using and physical actions that you were doing. When you do movement and you're looking at the development of neural pathways, that's more a physical process. And then there's the external motivational factors that have to do with the way that the brain is taught and learns, and all sorts of external things are used. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, and a lot of what they're looking at tends to be more technology-oriented. How can they augment the capacity of the brain through augmented cognition by bringing technology? And part of the dialogue we got into in this discussion was, hey, have you thought about the plasticity of the brain? If you think about what environment you can create that helps the brain get additional capacity and capability, which is already there, rather than first automatically going to technology to figure out how to enhance your brain function. And it's an interesting discussion for this group of scientists who is used to more on the technology side, but now they're bringing in biologists, psychologists, sociologist, looking at what some of may say is on the softer, more activity-based, rather than trying to bring in the nanotechnology and try and do the implants associated with that. And, you know, my sense is, in reading your book, your whole focus was, how do I help get that rewired because of the plasticity without the technology? Technology enables us, but fundamentally, we've got a lot of capacity and capability that can be taken advantage of if we know how to access it. And you certainly were able to access that through the process that you went through. Is that making sense?
Yeah. And for me, you know, I had minimal physical trauma. So my recovery did not require robots in order to exercise me, or any kinds of real technology that there's so much beautiful technology now for neurological rehabilitation. But that's really neurological rehabilitation of the motor system. And that was not my deficit. My deficit was cognitive. And so, for me, I had no recollection of my life. I had no past. I had no ability to perceive the future. All I had was the present moment. And it's really hard to learn anything when all you have is the present moment, because you have to be able to draw on information and associate information from the past in order to be able to make a relationship that gives you something now as an idea that's not simply an abstract concept, but it actually has a basis for you to be able to remember it. So I think I understand right where you're at.
So you had to not only learn, you had to relate past experiences and bring those two together as you're trying to rebuild your life. And as I recall, there are some things, you know, you included and some things you probably excluded. That you said, hey, I want to put that in, and hey, let's leave that one out for a while.
Right. Well, for me, you know, I really became aware that we are cells, we are neurons, and we are neurons communicating in circuits, and there were certain circuits that would allow me to wiggle my finger, or certain circuits that would allow me to learn how to put my socks on, and there were certain circuits that would allow me to attach this moment with the last moment so that I have a continuum of time over which I can learn new things and relate them to one another. And my mother could teach me in a moment how to put my socks on. And eventually I got really good at putting my socks on. And then in another times, she would teach me how to put my shoes on. And so I could put my shoes on. But I couldn't relate the two to one another over time, so I didn't know that I had to put my socks on before I put my shoes on, because that was a much bigger network of cognition that I did not have the capacity for early on.
So what's really interesting is I'm listening to all this, it points to the importance that our parents, our caregivers have in a number of important ways. One, providing relationships, which clearly your mother did, as the example just went through, putting socks on first before the shoes, because you weren't to the point from a relationship standpoint to understand those two. But right. But also, it sounds like, you know, touch, feeling, and then reinforcement also played an important role in things that you learned, you know, going forward as you started to begin to build these relationships and the elements, not only about sequence, but about feel, but about smell, about taste, all of those things come together, which is critically important for parents, mothers to know today, and a whole lot different than, for example, one might get with an experience with something called a flat panel or TV.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's very true. And for me, early on, it was all about touch. Everything was about touch. It was about the light was too bright. I needed it to be just the right level of stimulation, or it was too much stimulation. Sound around me, it had to be calm, it had to be soft, or it was too loud and it was chaotic. And the thing for me in the sensory systems was, if it was above my threshold of sensitivity, then I perceived it as pain. And as soon as I felt it as pain, I moved into high gear to get away from it. And it drove me into kind of a hyperactivity. But the one thing that I wanted to do constantly with everything was feel it. I had to feel things. But part of that isn't about just the tactile nature. It was in stimulating the portion of my brain that recognized where my physical boundaries are. Where do I begin and where I end? What do you think it's like for an infant who's a newborn into the world? How do they know where they begin and where they end? They probably don't have that perception, because that group of cells that creates a holographic image in their own mind of their body, in order for me to know that those are my feet, I have to have that circuit working correctly in my brain. Well, how do I get that boundary set for me? How does that information get stimulated in me? And it's touch. So I have to touch and I have to be touched in order to define the boundaries of what I am as an entity in order for me to be able to work with it. And I think that that's one perception that probably not many people have considered when it comes to children.
We had the privilege not very long ago of interviewing a very fine woman who's been a physical therapist for over 40 years. An expert speaker for the Physical Therapy Association in this country, which is going nuts over the fact that they're seeing kids come in to them at 6 months old who have the developmental profile of a two-month-old. And they're calling the condition container syndrome, kids who spend too much time on their backs being like carrying around, like some children would carry a doll around in a little buggy, and the kids aren't being touched.
Yeah.
And we're running around in the academic environment blaming schools and saying, when these kids get to school, why aren't they reading? Why aren't they performing? But they've spent so much time on their backs and not being touched and not being stimulated with the ability to move that it is now becoming literally a crisis. And what you're saying is supporting that from an adult point of view 100%, because it's saying that for you, what your personal experience was, was the same that I learned, again, back at the institutes with the people there, and that was that movement and language are, I mean, your ability to develop are all tied together, and you're calling it touch, but touch is in the form of you reaching out or pulling in and feeling things, the texture and the weight and the right. hotness or coolness or all of those things. You have 1,000 different kinds of things that are communicated when right. when you touch. And I think there's a very significant issue to be addressed there. We're going to be coming back in just a minute. We want to hear what you're doing now and how you're getting your message out to more and more folks. We'll be right back. Do tell me a little bit about your mom and about her contribution and how that affected you and how she knew what to go do, how you think she knew what to go do, because we want to talk more about this in relationship to new moms and kids.
Well, I really feel totally blessed to have my mom rear me twice. We call her Saint Gigi. Because everyone says, you know, your mother, she was such a saint, and she was, because she just totally gave up her life to take over mine again and to rear me back to being an independent young woman again. So I feel total gratitude for her, and people often will ask her, how did you know what to do? And she said, you know, she paid attention, and she says she did what she thought any mother would do, but you know, I know that she was really exceptional in the level of individual care that I was given. And there's just no question in my mind that if she were not paying attention to what I could do and what was the obvious unfolding of the next thing I should be able to do in helping me identify what is the obstacle between me and that next level of achievement. So she was really a wizard at breaking tasks down into smaller and smaller steps so that I could succeed. And you know, when you continue to succeed and succeed, you're motivated to try some more. And so she was very careful in not giving me too big of something to do because I would fail. And, you know, enough failure and you stop trying. And so really for her, she was a master at helping me stay motivated and willing to try to get better.
Well, it just talks so much to the important role that parents and caregivers have in all, you know, development, whether, you know, no matter what age we're at, whether we're an infant or anyone in our lives,
yeah.
to be able to see what's going on from our perspective and be able to help us be able to achieve those successes.
Yeah.
That helps, not only helps us grow mentally, physically, but also with self-esteem and all the other important elements are so critical to success in our lives today.
Yeah, no, I really was in a desperate condition and needed people to believe in me, believe in my ability to get better, even if it took, you know, years or months or weeks or I learned things very quickly. I just needed people to be very positive with me and to cheer me on. The attitude made all the difference in the world, not just my attitude, but the attitude of those around me. And, all I had in the early days was energy dynamics. And you could talk to me, and I'm not going to understand what you're saying, but I'm going to get whether you're bringing me energy and cheering me on, or if I'm just the next thing on your list of things that you have to accomplish before, you know, you get to go home from your service. So it was, it's very important that people take responsibility for the energy that they bring to me, and that would, you know, that totally applies to children. Children are extremely right brain sensitive. They're picking up all kinds of information, trying to make sense of the world around them, and if someone comes at them with hostility or negativity, they're just gonna shut them down, and once you shut yourself down from learning, then it's gonna just have a ripple effect on how you choose to interact or not interact with the world.
Well, tell me something. We're asking you and we're talking about this, but you've commented that you hadn't really been talked to much about this. You've done lots of interviews and
right.
nobody else has really brought this up?
Yeah, no, this has not been a subject in applying this to children and to parenting. And so this is really an eye-opening for me because it's so true. I was essentially an infant in a woman's body, and my mother, when she first came to see me, she describes me as a breathing body in the bed. That's what I was, a breathing body in the bed. And she came around the corner of my hospital room and gave direct eye contact to me immediately. And I didn't know what a Gigi was, much less who Gigi was or what a mother was or that this was my mother. And she comes around the side of the bed, and my doctors are there and my colleagues are there, and she acknowledges them. And she walked around to the side of the bed, picked up the sheet, crawls in bed with me, wraps her arms around me, and starts rocking me as though I'm her baby again, because I was her baby again. And, you know, people say, well, how did you know to do that? And she said, there was nothing else to do. She was an infant, and that's what you do with your infant. You hold them and you rock them and you create a new relationship with them. And so, I'm very clear that I was reparented, and it's been 12 years since the stroke, and I really am a 12-year-old in many ways, because I only have 12 years of emotional baggage from starting over again, which is really very nice. But at the same time, I had never really talked to people who were interested in how does this experience apply to what we can learn about newborns and infants and children and what they need in order to be fully developed and prosperous human beings. So I think it's great. So I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, and we're more than grateful to you, because I think there's a world of people who need to hear your message, because they're struggling with a lot of decisions about how to help kids do better, and all we're finding in schools is that kids are doing worse and worse and worse on the whole, and there are more problems. And I think that what your mother did by, I guess perhaps, what I'm hearing you say is she did it more by default, not because she had a particular pattern other than the good instincts that the mother has.
Right.
You would find that at the institutes, they would say that the mothers are the child's best teacher. They know. And when given the privilege to do what mothers feel is the right thing to do, they will. They will hold their child, and they will break tasks down, and they will be sensitive and thoughtful.
Well, and I think it also talks to the importance that so many in today's society believe it's the educational system that educates our children. But the facts are, our children only spend 12% of their waking hours in the classroom.
Right.
Which says they're impacted in much more significant ways outside the classroom. And the classroom is an opportunity to experience and gather knowledge, but the application of that and putting it in context typically has to occur outside the classroom. And the parents, the community, caregivers and others that interact are so critically important to childhood development all the way through their cycle till they become adults.
And Jill, our concern is the number of people who sit in chairs and sit in front of TVs or screens or video games or whatever they do. And I don't care if they're moving their thumbs and they're hearing this chaotic sound. The brain is not developed in such a way that, from what we can understand, it really absorbs that in a way other than just to have it sort of pass through. And and my concern is that we're not paying enough attention. We've unleashed this giant electromagnetic energy in their hands with little or no thought as to the long-term effects. And so you can see now, I think, in our conversation why we feel that your input and your thoughts, just a few thoughts you might have if you were just talking to moms or even talking and saying to your mom what it was you were grateful for, I think just the notion of her holding you and touching you and revisiting tasks and breaking them down and being thoughtful to your energy field, I think all those things are just of incredible importance and value.
Jill, what could we do to help you? Because you've got a very powerful message, some terrific insights. I would say you're doing a great job getting your message out, but what might we at Birth to Work be able to do to help you be more successful in what you're doing?
Well, you know, that's interesting because right now what I'm doing is I'm doing quite a bit of corporate keynoting because corporate America is really very interested in figuring out how to capitalize on both hemispheres of the brain and how to help people recognize their own creativity, and how can we set up an environment where people, adults, in their jobs can be creative and can feel supported in that, and at the same time get the business of the day done with the efficiency of the left hemisphere. So the corporate world is quite interested in both hemispheres, and who are we, and what can, how do we capitalize on ourselves a little bit better. The other thing that I'm doing is working on the creation of a medical device which is designed for neurological rehabilitation from people with any type of neurological trauma, whether it's a stroke or even our warriors coming home from that type of trauma, or motorcycle accident, any type of real trauma. So that's pretty much where my energy's been going. I haven't really thought about how to distribute more information to this particular population, which really is an enormous population, which would really benefit from it. I've been a loud advocate for right hemisphere activities in our schools, and how important it is to have a balanced brain, not just a school that focuses on the left hemisphere details. But I really have not applied it to, in my own mind, to parenting, so I would be open to suggestion on that.
Well, you can be very clear and very certain that we will be following up with you on that exact topic. We're going to have people who are going to be waiting to hear that message in our next interview with you, Dr. Taylor, and I appreciate your letting me call you Jill. I feel like I know you, you're a friend, you're doing work we both care about, and we will be back with more on the voice of the community stakeholder leader. This is Elaine Scott, Rick Stevens, and Jill Bolte Taylor, PhD.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.